Blog Talk Radio.
Many times selling your practice is thought of as an exit strategy, but it can be a growth strategy too, and something worth looking at earlier in your career. Today on Advisor Radio, we're joined by Rob Wolf and members of his team, and we'll be discussing with him the advantages of becoming part of a larger group and how you can leverage a new partnership. Hello everyone, and welcome to Advisor Radio, broadcasting to you from Horse's Mouth headquarters in downtown New York City. My name is Doug Pierce, assistant editor at Horse's Mouth. Thanks for listening in. And joining me is Horse's Mouth Senior Editor Nicole Coulter. Hi, Nicole.
Hey, Doug. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Great.
And before we kick things off, I just want to remind our listeners that we're always ready and looking to take their live questions during our shows. So at any time during the show, they can dial in at 347-215-7291 and hit 1 on their phones to alert us, and we'll get them on to ask. And also for those listening to the show after it's aired, whether through their web browser or audio device, we want their questions too, so they can just send them at radio@horsesmouth.com. Okay, well, without further ado, let's get started. Nicole, would you like to introduce our guests?
I certainly will. Thank you, Doug. Well, as you mentioned, most of the time when advisors think about selling their business, it's so that they can retire. But we're going to learn about today that selling can also be an option much earlier in their careers to help them to grow. And I'm joined today by financial advisor Rob Wolf of Capital Planning Group, which is now a division of United Capital, and he's based in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome, Rob. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Doug. It's a pleasure to be here today.
Yeah, and we're going to introduce our other guest shortly, but I wanted to just let our listeners know that you had actually read an article on Horse's Mouth about when advisors, how they can sell their practice at the end of their career, and you had actually just gone through an experience where you had sold your business to as an expansion strategy, and you joined a larger network, and I wanted to talk about what some of your career motivations were in doing that. First of all, if I just might give a little bit of background about you, I know you've been in business since about 1992, and you had to rebuild a couple of times as you relocated from Delaware now down to South Florida. But you are in the range of about 300 million assets under management, and you were experiencing some really great success. And I know you have a niche with high-end specialty physicians. But tell us, what really got you to the point where you started thinking, I need to go a different route. I need to expand and sell this practice.
Sure. Well, I guess the history dates back to probably the middle of 2008, where my partner Neil Slasky and I were having dinner together, one of those just catching up kind of dinners, and it morphed into and evolved into about a six-hour conversation where we started talking about each of our own internal growth strategies that we saw for our company, Capital Planning Group. And the more we talked about it, the more we realized that it was time to really gear up for more rapid expansion. So when we started looking at our options, we didn't need to be acquired, and we certainly weren't looking to be rescued like a lot of firms perhaps were in 2008 and early 2009. In fact, from a new financial planning revenue production perspective, 2008 was by far our best year in our company's 10-year history. Mm-hmm. So we weren't looking to be acquired for the big payday. We weren't looking to retire. We weren't looking to reduce our hours. And, in fact, since we officially became part of United Capital exactly 106 days ago, we've been working even more. We're very passionate about this business, and we're motivated by the opportunity that all the economic chaos and confusion has created in the marketplace. So we think that there probably will never be a better opportunity to grow a true client-centric independent wealth management practice.
Right.
And as I'm sure a lot of the folks on the call know, there are a lot of high-quality advisors, whether they're in wirehouses today or they're just independent already, they're considering making a move. So we thought
Now you've always been an independent financial planner, correct?
I have always been an independent financial
planner. Yeah, and so it was never, and I don't know if this would make a difference if somebody is, currently working for a large firm like a large national wirehouse. But mainly what we're talking about here is people who are in independent firms who, you worked for, tell us a little bit, first of all, about Capital Planning Group and how you, what your status was there prior to your merger with the larger group.
Sure. Capital Planning Group is a fair-sized firm. We have a total of 15 professionals. Mm-hmm. We manage about $300 million of assets under management, and the vast majority of the client relationships are either under my responsibility or my partner, Neil's.
Mm-hmm.
So we are a true fee-based planning firm. So although we do manage $300 million of assets under management, the fees generated by those assets represent only about half to maybe just slightly greater than half of the total revenue of our firm. The rest is comprised of the annual financial planning fees that our clients pay to us, as well as any other sales that come out of the planning process, whether the client has estate planning needs, 529 needs, things like that.
Right. Do you have a Series 7 license?
I do. I have a Series 7, a 66. I'm a certified financial planner and also life, health, and variable annuity licensed.
Mm-hmm. Now, you you owned a small portion. Tell us about, what your structure was prior to the merger, versus, what it is like
sure.
now in terms of your broker-dealer relationship, your RIA, that type of thing.
Sure. Capital Planning was formed in 1999 as a joint venture between two larger organizations. One is an accounting firm based here in Miami, and the second is a large commercial property and casualty and health benefits agency, also in Fort Lauderdale, Miami. Their name is Seitlin, S-E-I-T-L-I-N,
mm-hmm.
and between the two of them, they were doing a lot of business together, and the owners just had the idea of starting a fee-based wealth management firm to help serve the needs of the affluent clients that each firm already had.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually joined the firm in the year 2000. My partner, Neil, was the president of Capital Planning Group from its inception in 1999.
Mm-hmm.
We had our own broker-dealer, and we also had our own RIA. So for the first approximately 10 years, we were operating under that system. Neil owned a part of the company. I owned a part of the company.
Okay.
And when we had that conversation I mentioned earlier in the interview, we were talking about really what we needed to do in order to convince the other owners of our firm that this was a tremendous growth opportunity.
Now, we'll talk about that growth opportunity. What were you seeing? You're in a bustling part of the country and high net worth area, but what opportunities were you seeing that you wanted to take advantage of?
Well, in our experience, any time that the economy is doing exceptionally well and the stock market is doing exceptionally well, there are a lot of affluent families that are very comfortable with the status quo, and maybe they're not doing as well as they could be doing, but there isn't enough pain or discomfort or anxiety associated with their financial situation to perhaps engage a more comprehensive planner, which is what we are. I believe that all of the economic turmoil has made people wake up and really question whether or not they, no matter how much money they actually had, if they were okay.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we have never been hired by more clients to be engaged in the comprehensive financial planning process that we use than we had starting, maybe in mid-2008 through literally today.
Mm-hmm.
So as a result, we just saw this huge group of people that needed our help.
Right.
And we really knew that we were just scratching the tip of the iceberg.
Well, you had hired staff members, so obviously you had expanded your capacity that way, correct?
Sure, absolutely. But we really wanted to bring in other very high-quality planners, other seasoned professionals with at least 10 years of experience, perhaps even a book of business, that we could leverage the process that we've created in order to help them help their clients. And, there are only so many ways you can raise money, no matter where you are. And, one is clearly traditional financing, whether it's through a bank. Then there's also non-traditional financing. We were also considering things like trying to find local equity investors, private equity firms, and then we came to the last choice. It wasn't the last choice, but just the last one on the list, considering roll-ups or what United Capital calls themselves a transformational acquirer.
Mm-hmm. And this is opposed to just adding you know, a financial planner. What did you need the capital for, in other words?
We wanted to be able to go to somebody who already had an existing book of business and make a viable business proposition to them,
mm-hmm.
to basically merge their practice into ours.
Right.
And in order to do that, you need to have capital to offer them up front.
Right. Did you have an idea how much capital you needed?
We didn't know exactly how much capital we needed, no. But what we knew is that in our current structure, with the ownership the way it was, we didn't have any. So we knew it was greater than that.
Yeah. And so with those other options, what really nailed it for you to go with the third, the roll-up option?
Well, being financial planners, as I'm sure most of the folks on the call are, we went down the path and explored every single option. So we, of course, created our typical spreadsheets and looked at the pros and cons of each, and very quickly realized that, you know, in this transition, we were both going to raise the money to buy out our former passive owners, and then we wanted to decide if we wanted to continue to do business on our own and just have a very nice firm and grow it at a nice rate like we had been growing it, or if we really wanted to ramp it up and become part of something much larger than we could otherwise build on our own.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what really helped us focus a little more on the roll-up or transformational acquirer strategy. And you're right, there are lots of other firms in that space. So United Capital is not the only firm in that space.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of different choices that we had to go through, and we created what we think is a pretty decent due diligence and vetting process in order to, you know, really spend our time with the firms that were likely to be the best fit for us.
What specifically were you looking for?
Well, we were looking primarily at seven key factors.
Mm-hmm.
First, at the top of the list, this is a theme that you'll hear throughout this call, is the capital we needed to aggressively grow our practice.
Mm-hmm.
The second is an impeccable reputation to assist in our recruiting efforts. And our other guest, I don't know at what point you'd like to introduce him, but
maybe we should, I don't want to interrupt your 7 points. We'll
okay.
come back to them. Let's bring Matt on. We've got Matt Brinker, who is the Vice President of Acquisitions with United Capital in Newport Beach, California, joining us today. Thanks for coming on, Matt.
Well, I appreciate the time. Thanks for having
Thanks
me.
Thanks for patiently waiting there. We'll
Not at all.
Introduce you, but you're going to be talking about, you know, what this kind of opportunity can look like
sure.
for financial advisors. And I'll turn it back over to Rob to
sure.
talk about how he got connected with you.
Sure. Well, the second point that I just made, the mm-hmm. recruiting efforts, the reason I wanted to mention Matt at that point is having met him early on in the process and realizing what he brought to the table and the process that he used to find and identify other advisors was a big component of our decision. So the others are superior technology. We had a decent technology platform already in place, but like a lot of advisors, we're somewhat frustrated by the fragmentation in the tech space. You have one software that might be a contact management solution, one that might be a relationship management solution, one's a portfolio management solution, a financial planning solution, and we had an accounting solution. And they were all siloed types of applications. So what we really wanted to do is find a technology solution that kind of melded those all together so that our team could enter things once or at the very worst twice rather than having to rekey data on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
And things like that just weren't available to independent firms like ours without significant cost.
Right.
What we thought was significant cost. So the next one is superior operational and administrative infrastructure and support. The next is the opportunity to collaborate and interact with other high-quality advisors who also targeted the affluent marketplace,
mm-hmm.
access to intellectual capital, and then access to talent, whether it's existing talent that's already part of the firm or a structured way of attracting and retaining good young talent. Those were the seven main things we were looking for.
Wow, that's a good list there.
Thank you.
Did Matt help you with that, or did you just come?
We actually came up with this list before we met Matt, so that
yeah,
we could.
Yeah, how did you actually meet?
How did we meet, Matt? Perhaps you can.
I
believe somebody introduced Matt to my partner Neil initially.
Yeah, mm-hmm. that's right. And just as far as how we identify potential partners is that we lever what we consider centers of influence, and we also have investment banks on a retainer who are out identifying potential partners on our behalf. And
mm-hmm.
one of the investment banks identified Neil and Rob. So
mm-hmm.
that's how we came across each other.
Well, and you had an investment bank relationship in the Fort Lauderdale area?
No, no, this is actually a Philadelphia-based investment bank.
Hmm. They knew Rob, huh?
Well, that's their job.
Yeah.
They, their responsibility is to help us identify groups that have, you know, first and foremost, the cultural match, and then some certain levels of business congruencies as well.
Did they know him from when he was up there before as an advisor, or because he was in Delaware?
I don't know the backstory.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You don't know that backstory, Rob?
I do not. I do not.
Yeah, okay.
Honestly, I don't know.
Maybe it's not important. But Matt wanted to ask you about, you know, your firm. Can you tell us, can you give us the scoop, kind of a summary of of who you are, what you do, and how long you've been doing it?
Sure. Can I start by saying what we're not?
Yeah.
Yeah,
sure.
we're not a roll-up firm, and and we've often get lumped into that conversation because we happen to grow via acquisitions.
Yeah,
and oftentimes roll-up firms, because they do have an acquisition mandate, we tend to get lumped into that dialogue, and where we really try to focus on our separation is the difference between a financial acquirer and a strategic acquirer. A financial acquirer, and I think is aptly named, a roll-up, because they're really an argument of an arbitrage, meaning they defend that the sum of the parts are greater than the whole.
Yeah.
And you amass a certain amount of cash flows, you amass a certain amount of assets under management, and the argument is there's a multiple expansion. We don't subscribe to that. We more subscribe to a strategic partnership. And our overarching objective is to create a national independent wealth management firm that is owned and operated by its partners that provide a wealth counseling solution via an open architecture, independent, non-proprietary product platform.
Wow.
And we see a massive paradigm shift in the industry, even before the market meltdown that we saw last year and into this year as well, as and Rob alluded to this, as a focus for clients to talk about things that they can control and be in a position to deliver a planning solution to answer one very simple question: am I going to be okay?
Right.
And what things do I need to do in my life in order to ensure that I'm going to be able to reach my financial goals and objectives? And so we see just from the consumer level a massive amount of demand for that type of service.
Mm-hmm.
We also see the breakup, effectively, of the supermarket model of investment services, the Citibank model, right? Checking, savings, mortgages, insurance, soup to nuts, top to bottom. And it's just, that clearly doesn't work. And what we think we're going to see is a bit of a back to the future, where there potentially could be perfect silo plays, effectively, of businesses that service a specific client need. And what we want to fill is that pure play wealth counseling, talking to our clients about holistic life planning, being their financial coach, and looking at the investment management as mission critical to their path and them reaching their financial objectives, but not the key driver of our relationship. We see the investment management side of the industry becoming more and more commoditized. The proliferation of ETFs, go to eTrade.com and pay 30 basis points and get a very compelling asset allocation based upon a risk profile questionnaire. And if that's your experience, or if that is your client's experience, how do you rationalize charging 130 basis points?
Right.
And so the network of firms that we've partnered with, Neil and Rob embody this, is a planning-centric client experience. But
you provide them with some the leverage and the depth and the, you know, you're a $12 billion national firm.
Well, it's mandatory, mm-hmm. right? Because what we know, what we've audited and identified in the industry is that it's very challenging for a wealth management firm to deliver consistently a wealth planning solution. It's laborious, it's time intensive, and typically, if it is delivered, it's usually not something that advisors charge for. It's a mechanism to capture the asset management fee.
Yes.
So you're giving away advice in order to capture the asset management fee. Well, our view is that the planning is the most valuable part of the client and advisor relationship, and there should be a monetization event for that service.
Mm-hmm.
And so we encourage our firms to not only deliver a consistent planning solution, but charge a fee for this service.
Mm-hmm.
I
think that's really getting to the level I've heard advisors talk about. Raising the professionalism of the industry, because as you talk about it, it has evolved from a sales culture of investment products, and still now there's kind of this hybrid of, you know, people are charging for the assets under management, but kind of giving away the financial planning, and it isn't standardized across the industry. And so I think it's interesting what you're talking about. You have a vision of really delivering that valuable service and advisors getting paid for it.
Well, and there's two challenges to mm-hmm. that. Is one, being able to consistently deliver a valuable client experience in and around advice.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've noticed in spending hours and hours and hours in the offices of potential acquisition or partners is they're typically, by most industry standards, wildly successful in that they manage anywhere from $150 to $600 million of assets under management.
Mm-hmm.
And typically the profile or the culture that the advisor has created, and you alluded to this a little bit, is more of a lifestyle sales business.
Mm-hmm.
And along the way, they really haven't built out infrastructure, technology, process, and eventually they hit a growth ceiling. They hit a growth ceiling.
Right.
The business that they've created doesn't necessarily support a move through the next level or a greater trajectory of their growth curve.
Rob, I want to bring him back in just for a second, but is that what you felt like? You had hit a growth ceiling, or was it a capital ceiling, really, for you?
Well, I think that before we met the folks from United Capital, we had a pretty good system in place, and we had lots of very structured processes and procedures mm-hmm. in place. I think that the lift that we really were able to get initially has been the technology lift.
Mm-hmm.
The processes that we're using, some of them we're going to keep, and in some cases maybe will become part of the greater United Capital model. Others, we were able to benefit from the work that United Capital had already done.
Yeah.
And every firm is going to have certain strengths and weaknesses.
Yeah.
And so what we need to be able to identify back to the point of being a strategic acquirer is we come in and we do a day and a half audit of the business
mm-hmm.
in order to be able to identify where we can add value. The enterprise value as a whole, United Capital, is contingent upon having 60 metro offices around the country operationally at a higher level. And
yeah.
we need to be able to identify in areas of administrative support, investment management support, practice management resources, and the centralization and the delivery of a planning deliverable.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we've done is that we've partnered with University of Texas Tech in Lubbock, Texas,
mm-hmm.
and we have newly minted undergrads and graduate students coming out of their planning school, and they serve effectively as our offshoring of doing what we consider the $20 to $30 an hour work and getting that really off the desk of the advisor and the staff members in our local offices around the country, with the overarching objective of elevating not only the advisor's time, which is important, but arguably maybe even more important, is elevating the time and the productivity of the staff members in the local office.
Yeah.
And giving them career trajectory.
Yeah. How many offices do you have total, or how many partners do you have?
Yeah, we've done 30 partnerships in, mm-hmm. in 4.5 years, and there are 25 offices around the country.
Yeah, you mentioned to me prior to our call that there were there's been a real uptick in the number of acquisitions that you've been able to you know, be part of in the last 4 years.
Yeah, and you know what we're not interested in doing is capitalizing on the depressed values of the businesses
mm-hmm.
today.
Yeah.
You know, we have no financial motivation to take advantage. If we were a financial acquirer,
mm-hmm.
and our return on investment was a function on the spread that we get on the firms that we buy and what we sell
yeah.
them for,
yeah.
we might be more interested in taking advantage of these depressed valuations. But what we're really looking for in this market environment, again, continues to be focused on exceptional advisors in key markets that we can build around. Neil
yeah.
and Rob embody that. They are
You're looking for a long-term success.
We're looking for the average age of our advisors is anywhere from 45 to 50 years old.
Mm-hmm.
55
mm-hmm.
years old.
Yeah.
And some younger, some older, but they're still very much in growth mode. This is not an exit strategy. This is a growth strategy.
I love that.
Yeah.
Well, hey, I'm going to just check in with Doug and see if we have any questions coming in, and then we'll shift gears a little bit and talk about the actual transition strategy, Rob, and how you went about that. But checking back
sure.
in with Doug.
No questions yet, Nicole. If you are listening and you have a question for Rob or Matt, just dial in at 347-215-7291 and hit 1. Let us know. We'll get you on to ask.
Did you have a question, Doug?
Yeah. Well, actually, I did have a question for Rob about the next topic, the transition process.
Oh, huh.
Specifically, how Rob, did you have to? How did you prepare your clients for the transition? Did you have to cut off any concerns, anything like that?
Well, we did develop a very formalized rollout strategy, if you will, and it included having face-to-face meetings. We're already meeting with our clients anyway, so it was just one of the agenda items in terms of the growth strategy that we at Capital Planning had embodied and what my partner Neil and I chose to do in order to bring that to fruition. A lot of our clients are, you know, we have great relationships with them, so the depth and breadth of those relationships allowed us to have very open and frank conversations, not about the actual numbers of the deal or anything like that, but just about, again, what we were trying to accomplish and what was in it for them, why it would end up being better for them at the end of the process. And those conversations went exceptionally well. Just to give you a sense, as part of the transition, each of our clients, of course, had to sign something saying that they agreed to work with us once our firm, the ownership of our firm changed. Mm-hmm. And the expectation from United Capital was that it may take as many as 90 days from the time that we could legally have clients sign things until we were finished signing them. And in actuality, we did it in about 26 days. Mm-hmm. Now, it's because we were already having the conversations and the clients were on standby ready to sign whatever they needed to sign literally as soon as they received it. It was fantastic, and it came at a time that, to be quite honest, both Neil and I were a little bit, I won't say concerned, but clearly when you're asking your clients to make a move with you in one of the most challenging economic times that clearly I've ever seen in my career,
mm-hmm.
it was a little bit uncomfortable, but every single client has decided to come with us. So
you stayed in the same building, right, Rob?
Our office space didn't change from their
right.
perspective. Our phone numbers didn't change. Our
yeah.
staff didn't change. Nothing from their perspective changed. Other
Even the name
staff.
Of your firm, Capital right. Planning Group, which, by the way, has no relation. It was just coincidence that you merged with United Capital. Similar
That's correct.
Name.
total coincidence.
But what then was the most obvious noticeable change in the transition?
From the client's perspective?
Yeah, maybe from the client's perspective and then from your perspective.
Well, from the client's perspective initially, remember, we're only about 100 days into this transition. So Thus far, the clients haven't really seen or felt anything different than what they've experienced over the last 10 years if they've been with their firm for that long.
Yeah.
On a going forward basis, though, I do believe that they will be able to see some of the synergies and benefits of being part of United Capital. Since we are part of United Capital, if you think about it, a firm like ours who has $300 or $400 million of assets under management, we didn't have the leverage to aggressively negotiate things with larger organizations, whether custodians like Schwab or Fidelity or some of the turnkey asset management programs that are out there, like the FundQuests of the world or the Investments of the world. Mm-hmm. Well, now that we're part of an organization that has $12 billion of assets under management and growing exponentially, we now will be able to take advantage of and pass some of that advantage on to our clients in terms of fee savings or maybe minimum account sizes being reduced or access to products and services that we as a firm like Capital Planning, still a decent firm, a great firm with a great reputation, but just didn't have access to that kind of negotiation power.
Right, and it gives you the ability to go after some business that you wouldn't have been able to as well, right?
Well, I actually have a great story to share with you. Because we have partners throughout the country, we all have some things in common. Most of us have certain things in common, but there are some of the firms that United Capital has acquired that are different. And let me give you an example of one. About 2 weeks ago, Wayne Bogosian, the managing director of PFE Group, which is our partner from Boston, spent 2 days here in South Florida with me and Neil. And PFE is one of the country's premier pension consulting firms and has a roster of large retirement planning clients like Pepsi, Dunkin' Donuts, NASCAR, big firms.
Yeah.
So one of the challenges that Neil and I have had through the years is the fact that we have lots of personal wealth planning clients and contacts in many similarly sized firms here in South Florida, but we didn't have access to the expertise, or perhaps more appropriately stated, the client didn't perceive we had access to the expertise in order to garner those, you know, 20 million and up type
right.
of retirement planning opportunities.
Yeah.
We have 300 million, so if we go to a firm like here locally, well, there are lots of firms that have 100 million up and up in retirement planning assets. Nobody in their right mind would really say, well, this firm with 300 million can do a great job on our $200 million plan.
Yeah.
Whether we could or couldn't. Which it's
the perception there.
Right.
Right.
So during our time with Wayne, we learned a lot about each other's business models and the ways that we could be most impactful in helping clients. We shared our respective ideal client profiles and then started to brainstorm and talk about different opportunities that we could bring him in on and vice versa. 2 weeks later, within the first 2 weeks, the effort that we spent is already paying dividends. Last week, Wayne referred an opportunity to us to have an opportunity to capture wealth planning services for an executive, I don't know, probably about 20 executives at a firm someplace outside of South Florida.
They're outside assets then, yeah. Uh-huh.
Where it would be a company-paid financial planning benefit for their executive team.
Awesome.
And on the flip side, just a couple of days ago, I referred him an opportunity to work with a $30 million retirement plan for a publicly traded company that's based here in South Florida. So those are things that we couldn't have done before. We didn't have an outsourced partner that we felt that comfortable with, and now we have one of the top firms in the country.
Right, and they're part of the same team.
We're all part of the same team.
Yeah, that is a great story. And, you know, I wanted to shift back to Matt just a little bit, talk about some of the, you know, how does this all work financially? I know Rob told me that first, you know, he had to buy out his passive owners of his firm. But can you walk us through the financial transaction, what goes on in this type of merger?
Sure. So just philosophically, this isn't the liquidity event when one of our partners joins us.
Mm-hmm.
I'll start at a higher level. What we're effectively buying is a EBITDA or free cash flow of the business.
Mm-hmm.
And since we're dealing with independent advisors, were unbelievably flexible and accommodative in terms of how we structured the transaction. And a lot of the decision-making in terms of how much of the net income, effectively, the advisor wants to sell to us is really up to the advisor or the partnership team. And what we're doing is that we're simply applying a multiple to the net income that is sold to us, and it's a function of the integrity of the revenue.
Mm-hmm.
So recurring, non-recurring, age of the client, so on and so forth, length of the relationship. And there's a cash component to the transaction. There's a notes payable component of the transaction. And there's an equity component of the transaction. It's important to note that the transaction, since it is an acquisition of goodwill, it's taxed at capital gains. And I think most people are under the belief that there might be some adjustments to our taxes, income taxes. So it's a pretty interesting time to look and plus capital gains tax rates are most likely going to increase as well. So it's an interesting time to be contemplating a transaction. And so our long-term view of how the company grows and evolves, and this is where, you know, if you were to break down what United Capital does into two very clean segments is one, we're a near-term growth strategy for independent wealth management firms. And then there's the equity swap, effectively. What our partners are doing is that they're taking the equity in their business and swapping it for equity in United Capital.
Mm-hmm.
And their notion is, and as a shareholder, it's my belief, is that we are going to grow faster than any standalone wealth management firm could grow. And we will yield a multiple that is greater than what a standalone wealth management firm could yield on their own.
Yeah, especially a mature one like yourself.
Well, especially a mature one, and one that is large, one that is centralized, one that has economies of scale,
right.
Better margins, and plus, you know, we've been in this space before. The private equity backers that are backing United Capital, the CEO, board members built a firm in the 90s. Very similar idea. It was a wealth management firm called Centurion Capital, and it was eventually sold to General Electric in November of 2001 for a multiple that, again, most independent firms could not garner on their own.
Mm-hmm.
And so does that answer your question?
Yeah, I mean, just kind of getting an idea of what they can expect in terms of the financial transaction itself. Oh, jumping back to Rob, though, were you concerned about losing control of your business? Here you had, I mean, you were staunchly independent. You had built this up yourself. Did you, was that a concern?
Absolutely. As we considered all of our options, whether we wanted to just buy our passive owners out and continue operating locally as Capital Planning Group, or utilize a private equity firm to help us do that, or enter into an agreement with either a roll-up or a transformational acquirer, we are very cognizant about striking a comfortable balance between accessing the capital we needed to grow and maintaining enough control over our situation to effectively be able to carry out our very client-centric growth strategy. So it was right at the top of the list of concerns, yes.
And what gave you the confidence then that they weren't going to try to, dictate to you. Yeah.
I would say we asked no less than 1,000 questions around that theme. and the recurring response was, we've put all of these systems and processes and procedures in place. You, as the managing directors of your local office, your regional office, get to choose which ones you want to take advantage of and if you don't. And we asked that question. When I say 1,000 times, that's probably on the low side.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, we slowly but surely started to become comfortable with the fact that that really was the answer. And, now that we're 100 days into this, I'm still comfortable that that really is the answer.
And it helps, I guess, that they sound like you guys share the same philosophy of where this profession is headed and the kinds of clients you want to serve and where you feel the value is.
Absolutely. I mean, from a philosophical perspective, we're very much in alignment. Neil and I are 100% client-centric. It's hard to say never in any endeavor, but I can say for myself, I will never work for a firm that has proprietary products. I will never represent proprietary products. I don't believe that it allows me to enter into a client engagement with a level of objectivity that I need to look them straight in the eye and say, I am going to recommend whatever I think is in your best interest and not have any conflicts of interest at all.
Yeah.
So United Capital is in the same mindset. Also, the belief that the investment management component of our business will continue to become even more and more commoditized. There will be fee pressure. There will be the need to really focus on collectively throughout the industry the advice deliverable. So that's something we're already doing. It's something United Capital is already doing. And there are clearly a lot of other firms that are doing it. We're by no means the exception. But there are a lot of firms that aren't. And in my belief and Neil's belief, we were in alignment with United Capital's belief that the folks that are just hedging their bets hanging their hats on the investment performance theme and the investment portfolio management theme
mm-hmm.
would either have to change and evolve, or they would be out of business at some point, or the other choice is they would just be making a small fraction of the revenue that they had previously
right.
grown across, accustomed to.
How do you handle that in terms of, is it a retainer that you charge or a flat fee for your wealth management?
Sure. But let me just give the audience a little perspective on our ideal client profile. Now, we have some junior planners that work for us that have slightly lower numbers, but when I'm going out to personally take on a new client, they have one of four financial metrics normally. One is, and it's not all of these, it's at least one of these. It's a net worth exclusive of their home of at least $5 million. It's household income of at least $1 million, investable assets of at least $2 million, or an executive-level officer of a publicly traded company. That's my sweet spot. That's who I'm going after. So what I found is that I don't want to quote a specific planning fee until I review the client's information because I don't really know what I'm getting into.
Right.
So I give them homework before the first meeting. It's a financial plan documentation checklist, and it's all the things you would expect to have to bring to a meeting, tax returns, insurance policies, of course, investment statements, estate plans, liabilities, you know the list.
Mm-hmm.
And we go through that together, and at the end of that meeting, I assess the areas that I believe have the greatest area for improvement in their overall plan, and then I quote a fee. And that fee is then an annual retainer fee, whether they hire us to implement any of their strategies that we recommend to them or not. The fee schedule for our firm starts at $2,500. Now, most of my personal plans start around the $5,000 level, and I believe the highest fee any client's currently paying us annually is $40,000.
Mm-hmm.
And that's whether that has nothing to do with us managing money for them. That's
right.
Fee that they pay us for our advice.
And what percent of your total compensation then would be from the wealth management fees and the financial planning fees versus asset. Did you say it was about 50% or?
Well, I would say we would divide our revenue into three different categories.
Mm-hmm.
The first is the fee-based asset management fees, which represent 55% of our total revenues.
Mm-hmm.
The second category would be wealth management fees or these planning fees. They represent probably about 20% of our revenue. Then the balance would be implementation of one-time types of things, like let's say we'd go through the estate planning process with a client and they need more life insurance, or the life insurance they currently have isn't as competitive as what we were able to find for them. So it could be commissionable business on the life insurance side, disability and income insurance side, long-term care, Section 529 plans, that type of thing. We'd go into the third category, which is about 30% of our revenue.
And how does it work now being a partner and the revenue sharing? I would imagine you do have to split that with your partners now, right? United Capital. Can you walk us through, you know, how that part has changed being
sure.
part of that team?
Well, we have our own P&L at the mm-hmm. at the regional office level, and to the extent that we run a profitable business, my partner Neil and I participate in that profitability. To the extent we don't, we participate in that as well.
And so then that I mean, do you share in the profitability overall of the firm? Do you have to give back to the parent company? I mean, how does that work?
Sure. No, it all comes down to the income that we generate at our firm,
uh-huh.
and the percentage that of the EBITDA that Matt was referring to that we've sold, if you will, to United Capital. That's the percentage of our net income that they receive. As far as anything else, we own stock in United Capital, and
yeah.
somewhere down the road, it could very well turn into an old school type of investment partnership model, kind of like maybe the Goldmans or the Lehmans before they went public type of thing. But at this point, there is no distribution from that component.
Yeah.
And, of course, we own the stock.
Right. So, I mean, has it been a so far advantageous financially for you?
Absolutely. I mean,
yeah.
we've continued to work at the pace that we had prior to the merger. We've continued to generate great top-line revenue. We've had some expense reductions as a result of being part of United Capital. And Matt mentioned the part about Texas Tech, and I don't know how many of your listeners already knew this or know this, but Texas Tech has perennially been one of the best financial planning degree programs in the country. They win awards for that all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we have very smart, very eager, very highly trained financial planning interns literally at Texas Tech that we can source a lot of our work to allows us to then delegate that type of work to the intern team, and at the same time allows us to ratchet up the level of work from the existing team that we have in place. So the productivity enhancements we've already felt the impact of those, and we expect that as we continue to integrate, again, we're only 100 days in, we'll benefit from that even more.
Right. Well, bringing Matt back in, I mean, did you have anything to add to, you know, help people understand just, again, some of the financial
sure.
advantages
yeah.
of being part of a larger group?
Yeah, and I think I want to make a pretty distinct point around where, again, we try to get separation from other acquirers. Most financial acquirers are going to have a preferred position on cash flow. And so what I mean by that, let's just say hypothetically, I'll run you through a quick example. There's $1 million of what we'll call net revenue,
mm-hmm.
or what we'll call earnings before owner's compensation.
Mm-hmm.
And the advisor determines that they want to sell $500,000 to the holding company and retain $500,000 in the form of compensation. In a preferred cash flow position, which is not uncommon, and very similar to what people experienced over the last 12, 18 months, if there's a drop in net revenue, let's assume that there's a drop from $1 million to $800,000 in net revenue, maybe $700,000, the holding company in a preferred cash flow position captures their
$500,000. Mm-hmm.
So 100% of the reduction in net revenue is born of the advisor.
Right.
We don't operate like that.
Really?
Really.
Really?
And
that's good.
Yeah, yeah, really.
I'm sorry I didn't get into that distinction, Matt.
No, it's fine.
Matt is much more adept at this.
No, it's fine, Rob. It's just such a nuance in our deal structure, but it speaks volumes to our philosophy of being a partner. And how do you rationalize being a partner if your partners are suffering and you know your champagne and caviar on the other side of the phone line? So along with this reduction in you know revenues across all wealth management firms, we here took the brunt of that as well. And we're in the trenches with our advisors. And so
yeah.
As a strategic acquirer, our key focus is to improve two line items of an advisor's P&L, and this is just purely through a financial lens, is play margin defense. Okay, we've noticed.
I'm sorry, could you repeat that?
Play margin defense,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, we've seen over the last, you know, 5, 6, 7 years that top line revenue has doubled for most wealth management firms.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe, and it might be greater. But net income to the advisor has only gone up by 18%. So what do you contribute that to? You contribute it to the complexity of the business, cost of operating, cost of compliance, cost of support staff,
right,
so on and so forth. And so if we're capable of coming in and streamlining operations, elevating staff members, and improving the overall margin of the business, coupled with growth of the top line, growth of the revenue, well, we might have a pretty compelling offering.
Yeah.
And if we're able to do that 50, 60, 70 times around the country, albeit partnering with culturally oriented people that are client-centric, wealth planning focused, we might have a pretty interesting company.
Yeah. And what's it been like this year? What's your growth and revenue been like in profit?
Well, obviously we're a wealth management firm,
mm-hmm.
So our revenues have come off significantly. But the good news is, at the holding company level, we continue to do partnerships, and we continue to do acquisitions. And when we do acquisitions, we're acquiring more net income. So our objective as a company, and Rob alluded to this a little bit, is that we just took down another round of capital from Bessemer Venture Partners. Bessemer Venture Partners is one of the oldest venture firms in the country, and a very well-respected private equity firm and venture firm. They went and audited most of the wealth management space, and it happened to be convenient because we were at the time looking to add capital to finance our next several rounds of acquisitions, and they were looking to get a toehold in the wealth management space. Long story short, they are investors in the company. They have a couple board seats, and they view our model as a long-term 20, 30-year company. So typically with financial acquirers, they're financed by private equity firms that have a certain timeline on their return on investment,
maybe
right, 7, 8, 9 years. And you're seeing, I think, in the press, some of this pressure for liquidity for the private equity firms. And we aren't just convinced that wealth management firms are designed to be publicly traded.
Hmm. Repeat what you just said.
Well, we're not so convinced that wealth management firms are designed to be publicly traded.
Right.
We're regulated enough. You know, Sarbanes-Oxley, reporting to shareholders. And candidly, there's a bit of an incongruency between a client's objectives and a shareholder's objective.
Absolutely.
Shareholder
objective. That's what we've run
quarter
into with the big firms. Yeah.
You got it. It's quarter over quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And our clients' objectives are 3, 5, 10, 15 years out.
Yeah.
And when you look at post-IPO of Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, they demanded a certain level of compound annual growth rate quarter over quarter, which arguably may have compromised some of the decision-making that they made. And so if we're able to stay in a limited partnership structure and maintain the control of what we do for our clients, we're probably going to be better off. And we look at national law firms, national accounting firms, and there's one limited partnership still left on Wall Street. We're in discussions with them looking for some guidance on how it's structured. But if we can make distributions to partners and provide a liquidity pool, once we start creating enough EBITDA or free cash flow,
mm-hmm,
again, we might have a pretty compelling partnership.
Yeah. Well, it's a very interesting business model, and I appreciate you guys coming on today to share this with our listeners who may just be looking for, you know, something different they hadn't perhaps considered an option for their firm. There's ways that you can achieve your goals. And I wanted to check in with Doug. I don't know if we've had any questions that have come in.
No, the lines are still quiet, Nicole.
lines are quiet, but we know they're out there. And you know, just in wrapping up, is there anything that we didn't cover that you think we should have, Rob? I'll turn it back to you. I mean, you're new in this process, but so far so good, it sounds like.
Sure. I guess the thing I would say in parting is if any of the listeners are considering different business models, this is clearly one option that should at least be on their list. They should consider everything else that they've probably already considered up until this point, but this is clearly something that, in our opinion, and certainly we're biased because we've already voted with our feet and our wallets, if you will, but it's a clear, compelling case, and if an advisory practice and the individual partners and principals have the right mindset, have the right potential cultural fit, client base, et cetera, it may be a very compelling opportunity for them.
Right, and to leverage their business and really to grow like you had hoped to. I thought that was a great story about the partner, the referral that you with the partner up in Boston. So
yes.
Being able to be independent and yet be part of a team as well, because we do hear from advisors who, you know, feel kind of sometimes you're independent, you're disconnected somewhat from opportunities or possible outsourcing possibilities. And anything else, Matt, that you would like to add from your perspective?
Yeah, I would, and Nicole, I want your permission to do
mm-hmm.
so.
Yeah.
Just offer to your listeners an opportunity to reach out to me directly. Anytime we're interfacing
sure.
with a potential partner, I prefer them to be as well-informed as possible on all of their options in terms of staying independent, moving to another independent broker-dealer, contemplating a regional acquisition, or looking at a national acquirer to provide and I pride myself on taking a more consultative approach to our integration process. If they want to reach out to me directly, we can collaborate and talk about the landscape a little bit.
Great.
Do you mind if I hand out my phone number and contact information?
Yeah, or if they want to send me an email, I could put them in touch with you. That might be one way we could go about it, and then I could kind of know who's interested as well.
Sure.
My email address is Nicole, Nicole, at horsesmouth.com, and I will be happy to
Great.
Put you in touch with Matt Brinker, who is the Vice President of Acquisitions at United Capital. He joined us today from Newport Beach, California. We sure do appreciate it, Matt.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the time.
And I hope we can stay in touch with you. And Rob Wolf, an advisor in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and he's with Capital Planning Group, which is now a division of United Capital. And Rob, we do appreciate you taking time out today to share your story.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
And we'll send it back to Doug, and anybody listening that would like more information, just be sure to send me an email, and I can put you in touch with either Rob or Matt, and we do appreciate them joining us today.
Okay, great. Well, it looks like that's going to do it for today's episode of Advisor Radio. So thanks again to Rob and Matt for talking with us today. And if you're listening, be aware that there will be a replay available of this episode that you can get to from the Horse's Mouth front page. Just click on the radio button at the top menu. That'll take you to the resource page where you can access that. And we're always eager to hear your questions, comments, and suggestions. So make sure to send those off at radio@horsesmouth.com. So thank you, Nicole, for another great episode.
Thanks, Doug. Oh, and we'll have the links to United Capital website too up on the resource page for the radio show. So you
okay.
Can check that out. All right. Thanks.
Okay. Great. Well, thanks for listening, everyone. And until next time, goodbye.
This Horse's Mouth presentation is offered specifically for financial advisors and may not be reproduced, broadcast, or distributed without permission from Horse's Mouth. Unauthorized use, reproduction, or distribution of this material is a violation of federal law and punishable by civil and criminal penalty.